yes, I'm talking about searching for stellar counterparts to the lowest mass dark matter halos that compose the stars. And
you know, we sort of go by the general assumption that the lower the mass of the dark matter halo, the fewer stars you may expect it to host. So this all really boils down to searching for the very least luminous galaxies in the universe that we can see. And but when I use the word galaxy, I just am using that to refer to a group of self-bound stars that are nestled within their own dark matter halo. And so here on this first slide, your eye can probably barely pick out that there's some overdensity of stars here in the middle. And this galaxy is the Cetus dwarf galaxy. It's about 1 megaparsec away from us. Now, this dwarf galaxy actually is about 100 times more luminous than the things I'm going to be talking about today. This has, you know, for astronomers in the house, an absolute magnitude of about minus 10. The things I'll be talking about are, I said, 100 times fewer stars than this, but you couldn't see them at all if I was to show them here. So I've been in this game looking for these tiny galaxies for sort of a while, but the things, the new stuff I'll be talking about today is stuff that I've really been working on lately, in particular with Shane Walsh, a grad student about to finish at Stromlo, and Helmut Jurgen there. I've been working with them for a couple of years. And then I'll be talking about a bunch of stuff from a paper that's about to get wrapped up, led by Eric Toller, a grad student at UC Irvine, who's being advised by Louis, who's here, and James Bullock. Now, also by this title, I don't mean to suggest that I think that we have some, you know, preset idea of where the lowest mass dark matter halos are, and thus I'm doing a targeted search to find stellar counterparts. Instead, I'm talking about doing, you know, large surveys for these things. And I'm not going to be talking about, you know, halos like the microhalos that other folks are going to be talking about now. Here we have a picture of Via Lactea 1. It looks beautiful. And I got it probably from Jörg's website here. Now, over the course of the talk, it'll become clear that it's actually not as easy of a game as ideal to sort of map as many of these dark matter halos as possible by finding the stars inside of them. Up there's the Leo 2 galaxy. But, you know, for better or worse, right now, the best way that we have to trace the abundance and the mass spectrum and the spatial distribution of the lowest mass dark matter halos is by tracing them with their stellar counterparts. We'll hear about some other ways over the course of this meeting, but the best way we have now is with this. And so there are a few important things, important ingredients to this game. First and foremost, for us to really go from the 12 galaxies out of these, what, you know, about 10,000 subhalos, the 12 of these that were known to host galaxies in 2004. To make progress, first we need to identify new bound stellar counterparts to dark matter halos. And then we need to not just identify groups of stars that are, you know, in three-dimensional space bound to each other, we need to show that they're actually resident within dark matter halos. And that's something that Louis is going to talk about in the next talk. And then the second thing is, we don't want to just identify where these galaxies are and to show that they're in dark matter halos, but how do we actually do a uniform enough search and a well-defined enough search so that we can compare the dwarf galaxies that we know about around the Milky Way with the predictions of cold dark matter plus galaxy formation models. And this is something that I'll spend some time talking about, and it's extremely important. Up until, I would argue, very recently, even not quite at the present day, did we have a well-quantified description of what we didn't know about the number of dark halos around us that host stars. And then finally, to help folks sort of make testable predictions for the future, I'll wrap up by talking a little bit about prospects for upcoming all-sky surveys over the next decade. So really the key to finding these things, it's all about resolved stars and counting resolved stars. So most galaxies we're used to seeing look something like this, a fuzzy little blob. And this is just a miscellaneous dwarf galaxy from the local volume. And this guy is far enough away that we don't actually pick up individual dots in the body of it, but we see this sort of fuzzy blob. But one would never find the sorts of galaxies, things with 1/1,000,000th the number of stars of the Milky Way, things with surface brightnesses, you know, 100 or more times less than that of the night sky. We're never going to find those by looking for patches of diffuse light, at least not in any technique that is being used today. But instead, they're found, and they always have been found, by overdensities of individual stars. And so traditionally, all these 12 galaxies that were found around the Milky Way, nearly all of them were found in visual searches looking for overdensities of resolved stars against the night sky. And so here's one of the Milky Way's 12 companions, Leo 2. this galaxy, Draco, represents the limit of what was able to be done before 2004. And this Draco galaxy was found in visual searches of Palomar-Olsky survey plates back in the 50s. And it's a bit hard to see this at all with your eye, partially because of the scale of this image. It's only a couple of times the characteristic scale of this object. But if you sort of look at the center and look at the edge, you can see there's more dots in the center than in the edge. And this little diagram, you know, just taken from imagesgoogle.com, shows the state of how many luminous dark matter halos were known about before 2004. And you see here, loosely, is the plane of the galaxy. The scale of this image, it's about 300 kiloparsecs across, which is why these two most distant dwarfs have sort of arrows pointing up there to show where they're at. And for us to make improvements on the known population of dwarf galaxies, we needed a couple of things back, you know, 10 years ago. We needed something that was more uniform than these sort of visual plates that people had been using to find the dwarf galaxies. It just wasn't a uniform survey of the whole sky that had been possible to do yet. And the second thing is, we wanted to be able to find things that were a lot less luminous than the known dwarfs to really look for the least massive subhalos that were able to host galaxies. So the advent of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey is what has really been able to revolutionize the way that we're trying to use nearby dwarf galaxies to learn about the distribution of dark matter around the Milky Way. And so here's an Atoff projection figure in galactic coordinates. So here, I don't know if I'm strong enough to use the hockey stick. Okay, I'm gonna try this. Well, I feel like I'll drop it down to my head. Although I like it in print, I think a golf club might be better because it would be a little lighter. Anyway, so here is the plane of the galaxy. And here we have a latitude of 30 degrees, or minus 30, minus 60, and 90, which would be directly up and down from the galaxy. And right here would be the center of the Milky Way galaxy. And so look at this distribution of dwarfs. The blue things are the ones that were known about before 2004. And you can immediately see that only two of them are within 30 degrees of the disk of the galaxy. But 50% of the virial volume is within 30 degrees of the disk of the galaxy. And something that still isn't known now is how much of this is just an observational bias. Because if you're looking through the galaxy, right, there are very many stars between us and the dwarfs, so it's very hard to find them. Or how much of this is an intrinsic anisotropy in the distribution of luminous dark matter halos around us. And so what I show here in gray, and this figure is in Shane's paper in preparation. He's actually right now at the CFA where I'm from, working hard to finish this. Shows in gray what the footprint of Data Release 6 is for the SDSS. And so this is both an imaging and a spectroscopic survey. The most recent data release is nearly a quarter of the sky, 9,500 square degrees of imaging, nearly 22 million stars in the catalog. And so it's very wide field. It's uniform. If a star has a brightness of X at one point in the survey, no matter where you're going to see that star in the survey, it'll have that same exact measured brightness within about 2%. And so this is really extraordinary. And the final cool thing is that this imaging is not just done in a single band, but rather in five different filters. So we can use the brightnesses of stars or their colors in different filters, and their colors and their brightnesses to do searches for galaxies that can go much, much fainter or much sensitive than was possible before. And the principle behind this is that, let's see, so in about 1994, when Sagittarius was discovered, it was discovered as an overdensity resolved stars. There was some automated algorithm that went around. There were scans of these sky plates that spit out lists of the positions of all the stars in them. And you could calculate, find statistically significant overdensities. But you want to be able to be a little bit smarter than that, because the colors and the brightnesses of these stars are actually different than what you expect the colors and brightnesses of most of Milky Way galaxy stars to be. And so you have a color magnitude diagram where you have blue and bright stars in this corner and red and cool stars in this corner. And when a stellar population forms, the colors and brightnesses of those stars form with some main sequence, which is a diagonal in this figure. And as that stellar population ages, most of the dwarfs, we expect them to be rather old, sort of based on what we've seen before. The pattern of stars in this color magnitude diagram forms a very distinct sequence with a main sequence and a turnoff and a red giant branch. And if you compare that to this color magnitude diagram, if you take an image and you just look out through the galaxy in some random direction, the colors and brightnesses of the stars is going to look something like this, where you have the thin disk of the Milky Way, you have Milky Way halo stars, and you have Milky Way thick disk stars here. And so when you want to do a search for objects that have stars that fall in this region of the CMD, you can do selections for stars. You take in, you don't just take in everything and look for a statistically significant overdensity. And so, oh yeah, so here, for example, Shane Walsh is now doing a new survey of the SDSS data. And what he has done is drawn this template in color magnitude space, which is around where you think the red giant branch and main sequence turnoff should be, of a dwarf galaxy. And you can slide this up and down in apparent brightness to search for things at a range of distances from us. And so to illustrate this, I'll just sort of step through some of the imaging processes to give you a visual idea. And so again, we're not analyzing, and when I say we, I'm meaning it generally to be the whole community of folks doing this, not just the search that I did 5 years ago, not just the search that Vasily Bolokhorov did, who discovered many new dwarfs, you know, Dan Zucker, Sergei Kolposov, Shane Walsh. Everybody has the same general approach. And we're not working from the images. We're taking in the catalog of 22 million stars and breaking it up into these big chunks of data that you can analyze in some automated way. We're taking out the visual component of it completely. And so you can take in the catalog of all stars, and you can start applying different color and magnitude cuts to select out those that are consistent with being in a nearby dwarf galaxy. And you create some sort of a fake artificial image of the sky by spinning it up into space and counting the stellar density all across this fake image. And then you can also apply a spatial filter to enhance the signal coming from stars distributed as you may expect them to be distributed in one of these dwarf galaxies for about the characteristic angular size that you expect. Bless you. And you may get something out that looks like this. And so our eye can see that there appears to be a statistically significant overdensity. But again, when you're talking about 22 million stars, when you're talking about tens of millions of pixels of artificial images, each of which is analyzed for 15 different possible distances of dwarf galaxies, you need to have very stringent detection thresholds. And those are determined by the local density, the local standard deviation, and star counts. So in our search, we don't vary the size of the filter, but that's sort of varies from algorithm to algorithm. Some people use a couple different filters. Ultimately, it would make sense to do a much wider range of parameter space, not just in size, but in type of stellar population. For example, we're just looking for old stellar pops right now. So this is actually nothing. It's just illustrative of how the technique can bring out overdensities. But the first object that was discovered with a technique like this was discovered in around 2004, and it's satisfying. It's the only one of the new discoveries, except for Leo T, which is one of the most distant ones, which you can really sort of see by eye. And this is quite a deep image, which is why you can see it by eye. It goes about 4 magnitudes below the main sequence turnoff, although it is visible, actually, in the original SDSS images. And this object was formerly known as SDSSJ1049+5103, and it's now more commonly referred to as the Wilman 1 object. And it's this overdensity of blue stars here. But most of these things look a little something like this, where this is the Bootes dwarf galaxy. And even if it was very dark in here, we wouldn't be able to see anything with our eye as this. But here's a nice, this exact same region, the exact same size, what the processed image looks like. This is from Vasily Bolokhorov, who discovered, was part of the discovery team that found this object. It looks something like this. And so it's all about how you do the analysis on the stellar catalog. So that's a good question. It would be pretty hairy if we had to do that. And so the SDSS collaboration, all of the imaging data for that is run through some generic pipeline. And then the catalog is provided to the community. So you can go online right now and download this if you want to. Although I think to get the whole stellar catalog, you have to get special dispensation for disk space or something like this, or bandwidth. And it's not just as easy as finding statistically significant overdensities as this, because there are many things that could masquerade as overdensities of point sources, right? And so I just want to show you an example of a figure, or an example of how we can, after finding something that we think is a tentative detection of a dwarf galaxy, that we can confirm that it's there so that you believe some of what I say. And so this is an example of what the output might be from your code that runs for a week on all of these stars. And again, the details change from group to group that's doing this, but the principle is quite simple. And so you might have something that automatically spits out the spatial distribution, the how significant the overdensity is, and something that spits out the color magnitude diagram of the object and is already, in fact, fit what the best fit fiducial model is for what distance this thing might be at if it is an old stellar population. And this Bootes 2 object is actually the most recent and what may be the final satellite to be detected with Sloan Digital Sky Survey data. You can see that it really is not very compelling. You see that it's, yeah. Once you've seen a lot of these, you won't think that's statistically significant. It's very hard to see in the color magnitude diagram, although this was enough for a discovery paper. But then you go back later to the telescope, and you get deeper imaging, and you make a deeper color magnitude diagram, and you can hopefully see something emerge that looks like the distribution you expect based on known objects. Exactly, and so so the thing about Shane's algorithm that is better than what's been done before is we are using actual theoretical isochrones to carve out what colors and magnitudes of stars we accept, which is a difference from what other folks have been doing. So that's how we confirm that it is there. So based on this general procedure, starting back in the early part of this decade with stuff that I was doing, and then some groups at MPIA, at Cambridge, and now Shane Walsh, what we know about the Milky Way has gone from something like this to, oh, where's the animation? There it is. Yeah, Matt Coleman just gave me this week. It's very cute. Something that looked like something with just 12 galaxies around it. So now we have approximately 20 known satellites around the Milky Way that may plausibly be Milky Way dwarf galaxies. You might be thinking, well, 20 is still a lot different than 10,000 that's in Via Lactea. But you know, bear with me and wait to hear what Louis says as well. I'll skip over. This is just an example of a really crummy detection. There's still sort of stuff in the noise. We're trying to figure out what it is, and we don't know what it is. So we have found statistically significant overdensities of stars that are consistent with old stellar populations lying within the halo of our Milky Way, which is basically what we expect stars residing within a low-mass dark matter halo to look like. How do we know those stars actually lie within a low-mass dark matter halo? Yeah. So that is that's a really critical question, as I said, when you're analyzing so many stars and millions of pixels and this and that. So the detection threshold is actually set to be adaptive depending on the local density, because when you're in regions of high stellar density, the distribution actually you do expect to be fairly Gaussian, and so you can set a six sigma threshold and expect it to be quite robust. Poisson, yeah. But at the very lower, at lower stellar densities, things behave a bit differently. And then, and also once you're applying spatial smoothing, it's just. And so any individual object, the detection thresholds are actually set empirically, not statistically. And so what we've done is Shane's gone through and simulated maybe 10 SDSS surveys worth of artificial data, analyzed exactly the way that we analyze the actual data, and then looked at what the distribution is of detections and sort of set the thresholds high enough as a function of local density so that you only expect one purely false detection, pure SDSS survey. That doesn't mean that things that are actually detections are actually dwarf galaxies or actually star clusters, because we expect there to be a lot of galaxy clusters and a lot of sort of tidal craft in our halo. And so, no, exactly. And so to close the loop, and this is the most poor looking follow-up of any of the confirmed dwarfs. And so to confirm, once we just have a tentative detection, there is some finite possibility that it's not a true object, which I can't put a number on because, like I said, we don't know the frequency of galaxy clusters and tidal stuff. And it's really, that's why you need to get this to know for certain that it is an old stellar population at about one distance away from us, because if these stars weren't all at roughly the same distance, you'd expect them to be smeared out in apparent magnitude. And, you know, they could be, this particular system could be elongated along our line of sight a bit. And this is sort of the weakest example. And then this is the only example for which we don't have follow-up kinematics, which show that they're all moving together as well, which is the final ingredient. Exactly, line of sight velocities. I'm gonna have to wait for the animation again. And so now that we've, yeah.
Real, or is it a selection
effect? Here?
Yeah.
It's absolutely a selection effect. And so I don't know if you can see. So this is a central surface brightness of 31 magnitudes per square arc second. And so if anyone is familiar with surface brightnesses, they'll recognize that as being an extraordinarily low surface brightness. And so this is a very real cutoff. And even, and I'll show detection limits in a few slides or something, even sort of in this region of space, there could be a lot of stuff hiding in here, and even down around here at below surface brightness.
Nothing below that 29 line.
Well,
just below.
These are sort of right on a hairy edge, yeah. And the uncertainties, and so the boxes around these two of the very least luminous objects give a sense of what the uncertainty and then their properties are. And the uncertainties are similar for all of these sort of everybody fainter than maybe about 9th, 5th magnitude. They're quite large uncertainties. And these are even a little bit, I'd say, conservative uncertainty boxes. And so traditionally, when folks have discovered things and wanted to classify it as a star cluster without dark matter versus a galaxy with dark matter, it's just been a function of the size and the luminosity of the object. And so these open circles here are globular clusters around the Milky Way. And these guys up here and here are dwarf galaxies around the Milky Way, where all the filled-in dots are the new things that were discovered. And so at some set absolute magnitudes, globulars are generally much more centrally concentrated than dwarf galaxies. And up until very recently, people generally consider this to be enough to say, OK, well, this is a dwarf galaxy. But not so now. As you can see, as more and more of these objects are being discovered, you're starting to sort of fill in this apparent gap in size space between the objects. And so it really is that I believe that we need to get these line of sight velocities of stars of each of these objects and to ask whether or not we need dark matter to explain the kinematics. As I said, that's what Louis will be talking about.
The gap at higher brightness is real. That's not a question.
And so this gap right here?
No, further up.
And yeah. So this here?
Yeah, yeah.
Yes, this is not a selection effect. And this is not a selection effect either,
even down here at these low luminosities. And so, you know, there's a few things, right? It can be tempting to read into that. In other environments, there are objects observed in this gap. In the Virgo cluster, for example, there are a variety of either star clusters or dwarf galaxies that fall into that gap. This gap, it can be tempting to read into because there are tidal reasons to expect that things with globular cluster-like mass-to-light ratios can't survive in this region of size luminosity space, even at distances of a few tens of kiloparsecs away from us. They've got very little self-gravity just from the stars themselves. And so in a recent paper by Walsh et al. That we just resubmitted, we argue that, well, you know, objects like these, if they're self-bound, if they're not currently being tidally stripped, it's pretty hard to explain them having such large sizes unless they have mass-to-light ratios that are a lot higher than what you expect for a globular cluster. So sort of back of the envelope argument for explaining why these may be a continuation of the dwarf galaxy sequence. You mean if you looked at the galactocentric distance versus the, there are, so of the globular clusters shown in this figure, it includes the globulars that are consistent with being in the disk of the Milky Way, and it's consistent with those sort of both the inner and the outer halo globular clusters. And I know that there are gradients in some of the properties, but I can't at this exact moment remember how they go. And the largest scale size globulars, say perhaps PAL 5, which is getting destroyed, are generally in the outer halo. They're the lowest surface density ones. And there are tidal reasons. It's sort of a nature or nurture thing. Is it like that for which one? And between, you know, Simon and Jiha paper that came out last year and some other papers which published the kinematics, the line of sight kinematics of these things, everybody that has kinematics, all these filled in dots, and then Segway 1 and Wilman 1, which haven't been published yet, although Nicholas Martin actually did publish Wilman 1, they're all consistent with needing huge amounts of dark matter to explain their kinematics. But I'll just give a couple of caveat slides here so that we know to be a little careful. And Louis will mention this briefly as well. All of these five least luminous guys here, everybody that's less than about minus fourth magnitude or so. Their morphologies look sort of disturbed. And the question is, do their morphologies look sort of disturbed, where here's Coma Berenices and Ursa Major, although actually this is H1, this is the gas contours above it. This is Ursa Major, and we will show this as well. Do they look disturbed because of tides? Do they look disturbed because they have very small number of stars, and so the shot noise is making them look sort of disturbed? So for example, here's Willen 1 and Bootes 2, which are two of the least luminous things, things that have 1/500th of the number of stars in that Cetus galaxy. And you can do bootstrap resampling of stars in these two systems. And Bootes 2, if you just look at its isodensity contours, you see, oh, it's kind of elongated along the gradient of the potential. This is very suspicious. But this is not robust if you do bootstrap resampling. Neither one of these two are consistently distorted in the same exact way. So is it tides? Is it small numbers? Is it just sort of we haven't gone deep enough? That's unclear. But it's very important to keep this in mind because if stars from here are getting stripped off of this, they can't be resonant within very massive dark matter halos. There would be too much mass. They should be self-bound. But that's just a small fraction of these new objects. And so let's just forge ahead. We've got the kinematics. Everybody is consistent with being inside of a dark matter halo, save a couple of oddball cases. So within just the last 4 years, there have been between the Milky Way, which is what I've talked about, but also the nearby Andromeda galaxy, like 20 galaxies known or discovered that have between only 1,000 solar luminosities and maybe 10,000 or 100,000 solar luminosities. And this is extraordinary. This is well over a million times less luminous than the Milky Way. This is less than 1/100,000 of the luminosity that you need to be considered a dwarf. So, we've got how many, 5 or 6 orders of magnitude over which dwarf galaxies are now defined. So fine, again, so we've got these 20 things. What does this mean for the 10,000 subhalos around the galaxy? And so the one thing that is good is to take what we've discovered, take that we know we've looked at about 1/5 of the sky, and take what the detection limits are to predict what the true luminosity function is of luminous dark matter subhalos. And this has been done by a couple of people. Now I'm going to show how Eric Tollerud at UCI has done it. And so the first ingredient you need is for each one of the objects that you've found. So as a function of absolute magnitude, out to what distance from the Milky Way could you have discovered that thing? And so here, this is a figure from Sergei Kolpasov's paper, where he's shown the maximum volume within which you can find Milky Way dwarf galaxies as a function of their luminosity. So you can take this, and then you can say, well, if I can find things with an absolute magnitude of -4 out to 100 kiloparsecs, okay, I have one of them out to 100 kiloparsecs. Well, what fraction of all of them do I expect to be within that distance relative to the entire halo? And then you can correct for the total number. Oh, so sorry. So here is actually taking Kolpasov's maximum R max, the maximum distance of discovery, and this is a figure that Eric made. He makes these really nice, bright, sort of appealing figures. But I wanted to show Sergei's original figure to give him credit because he's the one that derived the detection limit. But here's Eric's visualization of that, where he's shown the completeness, the distance out to which each one of these objects could have been discovered, where the red are these new ultra faint dwarfs that I'm talking about. And this dotted line is the distance of Leo T. It's at about 410 kiloparsecs. And so Eric said, well, I want to make a corrected luminosity function out to 410 kiloparsecs. Let's do that. And these three different lines just show three different variations on this sort of maximum volume. And then Eric said, well, what radial distribution do I expect the luminous subhalos to have? That's a necessary assumption to use this approach to go to a total number of satellites. So there's many lines on this figure, but let's just focus on these juicy blue dots here with the large error bars. And so this is the radial distribution of the subhalos in the Via Láctea 1 simulation. And let's see here, where is, and here is the dashed blue line, are all of the Milky Way satellites within the SDSS footprint that could have been found anywhere out to 410 kiloparsecs. This dashed line is everything just within the SDSS footprint. And then here, this dashed blue line, is any of the dwarfs anywhere around us. So the things in the southern hemisphere and the things in the north hemisphere that could have been found anywhere out to 410 kiloparsecs. And you see that these two observational samples look fairly different from each other, but they're both consistent within the uncertainties or within the scatter taken from the Via Láctea simulation. If you go to Via Láctea and just draw 16 subhalos out of it, that's where these error got these error bars from. So even though you have to assume a radial distribution, which isn't that ideal, you can see that whether or not you pick this exact blue line, whether or not you just go empirically and take the more centrally concentrated radial distribution or this less centrally concentrated radial distribution. Exactly. So we're just trying to say, if we make an assumption, there are a variety of assumptions you can make. You can say, do I expect the radial distribution of luminous subhalos to be the same as that of all subhalos? All subhalos resolve in the simulation. Or you can say, I expect them to have the same radial distribution as all subhalos more massive than 10 to the 8. Or you can make some other assumption. And so in fact, one of these, so these two different lines, I should just go through all the lines. And so the green line are all subhalos that at any point in their past had a peak circular velocity greater than 10 kilometers a second in the simulation. The red line, all subhalos that right now have maxes of their circular velocity curves that are greater than 7 kilometers a second. And you see that sort of everybody is consistent within, you know, one error bar if you just draw 16 random subhalos out of Via Láctea. And given that no matter which of these lines you use, you're talking about factors of a few. Let's just talk about the approximate number you get if you assume they follow all subhalos. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Exactly. And I was one of the people that said that. And so there's a couple of responses I have to that. And so one response is that, so for example, Luminol 2004 did not consider this scatter owing to small number of statistics, where if you just drew a similar number of subs out, what do you expect the range of radial distributions to be? And that's actually probably the biggest response that I have to that. Another thing is that I and other people were a little bit fast and loose about the possible luminosity biases in the previous samples, and they weren't as careful about it. I personally think that the true underlying distribution is more centrally concentrated than that of all subhalos, but given that we're talking about factor of a couple, I don't think it matters for the qualitative conclusions. I knew Seth did that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I mean, basically, the models saw the curve.
Yeah.
And it was, there, it was pretty convincing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have other reasons to suspect there might be complicated factors.
Right. So, what you brought up today, what is it was really reasonably convincing?
Well, so one way of putting this is the two-thirds, well, as of, say, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, two-thirds of the observed satellites were within the half-mass radius of the halo.
Yeah.
Only one-third of the most massive subhalos would be, or something like that. Maybe it's not half-mass radius, but you can find a radius where there are far more satellites interior to that radius than there would be subhalos if you pick them by mass. And then a couple of people did work showing if you go back and pick systematically older or, you know, things that have a bigger VP because they formed early on and they've been stripped since, that sort of explains it. But if you just took the Via Láctea, painted the biggest dots, you wouldn't get the right distribution. It wouldn't be clustered enough.
But here it seems all right.
So here it seems all right, which I'm still trying to...
But it sounds like you didn't pick the biggest dots. You just randomly picked...
And so for the big blue dots, that is what Eric did, and then for... And it depends a lot, right, on exactly how many you pick. If you go to the simulation and pick the 12 most massive things, the radial distribution is going to look different than if you pick the 300 most massive things because you think there might be 300 luminous satellites. And so that's another thing that has changed. And it makes a big difference, especially when you're looking at the oldest subhalo. So I played around with the Via Láctea with different ways of defining what does oldest mean, and then what do I do if I pick 10, 50, 100, 300.
So there was no, the bias in the plot you showed before, didn't, that wasn't known, I think, or discussed fine when this discussion came up initially. Yeah. So it was assumed, I think, that there wasn't a completeness problem with radius.
It was assumed that there wasn't. Although, in Willen et al. 2004, I sort of said, well, everybody's assuming there's not this completeness issue, but maybe there it is a luminosity bias. So based on just what we found in this sort of 20% of the sky, right, sort of interesting, that, let's see here. So there's about 12 new things, and 5 of them are within 50 kiloparsecs. But all 5 of the things that are within 50 kiloparsecs could not have been found much more distant than 50 kiloparsecs. And so none of those, for example, are included on either one of these radial distributions. And so that's why, when you look at this DR5 complete, just things within the SDSS footprint, not including the sort of juicier dwarfs in other part of the sky, where this is, you've got Draco sextants that were found before, but really dominated by things more distant than 100 kiloparsecs that have been found by SDSS, it actually doesn't look that centrally concentrated anymore, and we really need more footprint to know what the radial distribution is underlying.
So that's after correction. The dashed line's after correction for this incompleteness.
So the dashed line is just ignoring everything that could not have been found out to 400 kiloparsecs.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
You've shown the distribution of satellites normalized the line at 417 kiloparsecs. Is it still true that the number of satellites is all right? That's part of what is planned. Wouldn't normalize it for 70 kiloparsecs.
So I think what you're asking is, is the number of subhalos much larger than the predicted number of satellites?
That's still true.
Yes, it is. But
well, I guess you've got to know how to do the prediction.
Observed number of satellites.
Where do you cut?
Yeah.
So
if you take the observed number of satellites, and then you take some assumed radial distribution, and again, Eric's done this for many different assumed radial distributions. This particular figure is just for the assumption where the luminous subhalos have the same spatial distribution as all subhalos, which might not be true, but within a factors of a few, you get the same result. And so if you do this, and then if you actually take everybody, take the Booty Stu and the Willman 1, the things that can only be found out to 50 kiloparsecs, and to implement a correction for how far away you could have found them, and well, I expect 80% more in the outer halo, this is the corrected luminosity function we find. Yeah, Jim?
Sure, no.
where what has been found empirically, right, from about 20, so that's this red line here. If you just correct for what Eric calls the coverage correction, we've only looked at a certain fraction of the sky, let's assume I saw T generally, and look at this. But then if you correct for this sort of Vmax, what's the maximum distance I could have found these things, I'm going to assume a radial distribution. He predicts approximately, 400. And depending on exactly how Eric does this prediction, he gets between about 200 and 1,000 luminous subhalos, similar to or more luminous than the known luminous subhalos of the Milky Way.
Within about 300 kPc.
Within 400 kPc is how he gets his calculation.
So what's the answer? Is there a discrepancy or not?
I mean, it depends on how you're asking that question. If, Jurgen might go back and run their simulation with 10-9-4, like there's going to be more subhalos there, right? There's going to, I think, necessarily a discrepancy between N subhalos and N dwarf galaxies. But
so another way of saying is in all these analysis, there are definitely going to be subhalos that don't have stars. They're going to be dark halos.
You have to know how to assign light to the
star. Okay. There's no way to populate every single dark halo with stars.
But wouldn't the way to normalize it be to ask it what dark halo mass do you get? 400 or 500, that's the number.
Oh, you've got to wait till Lulu's talk for that.
We're going to hear that.
He's next.
Okay.
But, yeah.
There was this body that wasn't claimed to be better than V, it was Vmax.
Oh, so no, this is luminosity.
So if you do the same plot versus Vb for Vmax, what do you get?
So this is luminosity. So this is just a number versus luminosity. So this has nothing to do. This is not trying to actually ask the simulation how bright are these subhalos. That's extremely difficult to do. This is just saying, I observe these galaxies, and I know those galaxies are that luminous. If I assume some spatial distribution, how many are there? It's completely aside from these sort of Vmax arguments or mass characterization arguments. That's what Louis will talk about.
There's an assumption here that the same fraction of the distribution of luminous dwarfs follows the distribution of dark halos.
And that was in
the assumption you check with the previous graph, this FBAR. The previous graph has a lot of, has a huge error bars because of so few satellites.
Mm-hmm.
So So this is an underlying assumption, and
yep.
the question is one can do better. They call it using Vmax, which measures the mass inside the satellite.
But that still requires, you're still going to have assumptions. So my point is, and what a point of this paper is, you can make all of these different assumptions, but you're still going to get a similar answer within a factor of a few here. And what to me, what does this mean? That means that once we have a future generation of surveys over the whole sky, and that goes deeper, A, we'll be able to test those assumptions, and we'll be able to say what the spatial distribution is compared to dark matter halos. But B, there should be hundreds of these things with which we can try to learn what the mass spectrum of dark matter is at the small scales where we can directly probe with stars. I'm not claiming that we know what the relative spatial distribution is, what the bias is between luminous subhalos and all subhalos. And so, let me just go to one last little slide here. And I'll just say that this is sort of, the work that I've just presented here really represents the first step to doing stuff like this. Because, I mean, every sort of thing was done in the most simplified manner possible.
For example, a really important thing to keep in mind are those sort of detection limits that I talked about. That assumed they didn't change as a function of direction you're looking through the Milky Way. That assumed detection limits didn't change as a function of how large of a size you spread the stars out over. Those calculations assume that the detectability of a dwarf galaxy is a step function. 50 kiloparsecs detectable, 50.1 kiloparsecs not detectable. Those two things aren't true. Those three things are not true. And that's what Shane's working on right now for the paper that's about to come out. And so here's the sort of general take-home messages. And I'll just leave that up. And if there's one more question before Louis talks, let's talk about it. No, but I'm happy to talk to you about it over a coffee break. A student of Mary Putman, and so that's actually pretty dubious. I don't think it's associated. I personally don't think that H1 is actually physically associated with that. But a student of Mary Putman's has done this awesomely nice observational work to put incredible upper limits on the H1 associated with all of these things, like tens of solar masses of hydrogen upper limits. Really, really nice stuff. It's on the AstroPH. I know that Mary Putman's a co-author. Her student's first name is Jana. Putman, yeah. P-U-T-M-A-N. Yeah, Putman. Andrew?
When the plot that you showed with the FMR distribution included, that was numbers of like 20-ish satellites, including the new, newly discovered one.
So there were three different empirical
models. I just want to know, has there been a change with the new experiment?
So it depends on how you slice and dice it, right? And so if you take all of the ones known before and then add the new ones that are detectable out to 400 kiloparsecs, then it looks fairly similar, a little bit less centrally concentrated. If you only look at the DR6 footprint, and take everything in there, old ones and new, that could be found out to 400, it's far less centrally concentrated than the sample known before. And I think what that's telling us is that small numbers are really dominating what we know about the radio distribution of Milky Way satellites.
Which salvado distribution do you assume is the, this for the radio distribution
of satellites
in the SRLA to this DG100? That statement's not really clear, because the luminosity versus surface brightness plot. Mm-hmm. The old ones are separated from the new ones.
They are separated, but it also depends, but I think that could be sort of owing to small numbers too, because when you add in 31 satellites to that figure, they sort of fill in the gap. I'm a little bit torn about how much to interpret that figure. Sorry, what did you say here?
When you get this 300 to 1,000,
yes.
Which subhalo radio distribution do you assume is the one?
And so when I say that the number 300 to 1,000, I believe that is, I'm going to queue up. Let me stop here.
No.
I thought you were going to beat me with that.
I'm putting in the head marks. Sorry, go on.
There are 10 scenarios in the paper, and when I put that number range into my brain, I intended to put in the range that sort of covered the range of plausible radio distributions. And if you look, it really is just a factor of a few different things you expect to get, given the satellites that he's using, based on the radio distributions that he chose to input. The sort of median being, assuming that The radio distribution of luminous subhalos follows that of all subhalos, because that of just the dwarfs in the DR5 footprint is even less centrally concentrated than that of all subhalos. You can talk about mine if you want.
The boxer and master there tend to be the other, you know, just because of time scripting, which affects the dark matter a lot, but probably the storm much less. I would rather take the green line than the red
one. The one the most massive in the past or the most massive
yeah,
right now?
Most,
I have plenty of my own prejudices, and I completely agree with you, but just in practice, between the red and the green line, there was less than a factor of two difference you would get the predicted number.
So also actually that distribution is resolution dependent. Mm-hmm. If you have a higher resolution, you will find the more substructure they were very massive. So actually distribution, so if you have extremely high resolution, actually if you quantify the substructure distribution for with the velocity peaks, you will follow the distribution for dark matter mass.
And so are you making the point that as you go to higher resolution,
yeah.
your radial distribution in the central region will change? And that's absolutely true, as you know, Jürgen might talk about in their paper. But the sort of the fluctuation you get in the very center isn't, based on the numbers that we pushed around, doesn't affect the total number that you predict. Again, it's a very large
Also, if you look at galaxy in clusters,
yes.
their distribution also follow the dark matter distribution. So I think probably it's true also for the galaxy.
But it's a little bit of, and so we had that discussion when preparing this paper. It's not totally comparing apples to apples, but that's certainly a valid point to think about the radial distribution of galaxies in a cluster. But the different sort of regime that, the different galaxy mass regime that we're able to probe, although I hate that word, with these ultra-faint things is different enough that it's not obvious that it should have, they should have the same radial distribution as things in galaxy clusters.
So, that's right. Let me just have one more question, maybe.
You said you had kinematics. So can you plot the Emax as a function, or is that what the next speaker is going to do?
Okay. Louis is going to satisfy and raise everybody's more questions.
So on that note, let's thank you.